Welcome to the Black Belt Podcast. I'm your host, Harinder Singh. Join me as I sit down with the greatest martial arts teachers, practitioners, and minds in the game. And together, we discover, explore, and learn from their knowledge, wisdom, and experiences. I'm on a quest to bridge the gap between sport, tradition, and reality. This is the Martial Arts Lifestyle Podcast. Come and flow with us. My guest this episode is Dexter Fletcher, who served for 35 years in the Miami-Dade Police Department, and 30 of those years was on SWAT as part of their special response team. He's a multidisciplined martial arts master with a third Dan black belt in Nisi Goju-Ryu Karate and Jiu-Jitsu, and a fifth Dan black belt in Nagasudo Jiu-Jitsu and Combative Arts. Mr. Fletcher specializes in training police, SWAT, and military units, both nationally and internationally. He has firsthand experiences protecting presidents, popes, and dignitaries. His highly decorated career has involved everything from frequent hostage rescue situations to hunting fugitives to protecting civilians from the monsters in this world. This episode is all about the makings of a guardian and what it takes to function at the highest levels in the most extreme and stressful environments. My key takeaway is that form must follow function. In life and death situations, when you're responsible for yourself, your teammates, and those who you're protecting, your training must prepare you to perform with zero room for failure. Heroes like Dexter Fletcher are a very rare and humble breed. They're guardians who put the preservation of others over their own self-preservation. I consider Dexter Fletcher to be a modern-day samurai who lives by a strict code of conduct driven by a definiteness of purpose and a selflessness dedicated to service and the preservation of life. We can learn so much from being in the mere presence of such individuals who truly walk the walk. I am humbled and honored to spend time with this remarkable man. Tune in for a life-changing episode. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Black Belt Podcast. I'm your host, Harinder Singh, and with me today, I have a very special guest, Mr. Dexter Fletcher. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and it's definitely an honor and a privilege to be here.
The honor and privilege is all mine. You know, we've known each other for a number of years now. We met through Eric the Trainer, and we've had some amazing conversations, and I wanted to invite you on the show to really express a lot of the knowledge and wisdom that you've gained, especially having the background that you do. I'd love for you to just take a moment and share your background a little bit with the audience so they can get a better understanding of who you are and where you're coming from.
Yes, sir. I'm retired. I just retired a year from law enforcement. I experienced 35 years of protecting and serving in law enforcement in Miami-Dade, Florida. For the Miami-Dade Police Department. My last 30 years was on the Miami-Dade SWAT team, known as SRT. My martial art background is in the traditional sense, and a lot of it's non-traditional. Japanese martial arts. I'm a third dan, a sandan in Nisi Goju Karate and Jiu-Jitsu. That's Japanese Jiu-Jitsu. And a fifth on in the system that I now currently teach, Nagasudo Jiu-Jitsu and Combative Arts. So my experience in there has been altered through my martial arts application has changed through my experience in SWAT, close quarter battle, close quarter combat, hostage rescue, all types of things that SWAT teams deal with, fugitive search, you know it. Everything that regular law enforcement couldn't handle, that's what we handle.
Well, you know, you're such a depth of knowledge and wisdom, also not just from practical knowledge and experience, but also you're a student of the game. You know, I think one thing that's really fascinating about you and your approach is that you have studied the traditional, but found ways to apply it in the practical sense due to the situations and scenarios you've been in. And you've been in many situations, scenarios that that we can glean as the audience. It doesn't have opportunities to be in those situations, but we can definitely learn from your experiences. And that's where I really wanted to talk to you about is, you know, when we take a look at reality, there's different levels of it. When you're working for a SWAT team in Miami, You know, like to quote you, as you said, you're dealing with monsters. You know, you're saying I'm dealing with monsters out there all the time, hostage rescue situations and situations that are not just you versus the bad guy, but situations where there's people, good people around that you have to also protect while going at it. It's a whole different world, I think, that people may not appreciate, especially sometimes being not having the same tools and utilities and resources that you guys have to go out there and do the things that you do is quite profound for many of the conversations we've had. And what I want to start with is, you know, first and foremost, mindset and the importance of mindset. And how do you prepare yourself for those types of situations where you're going into a hostage rescue situation where it's not just your, you know, you're not just in charge of your life and your team, but also other people that you're trying to rescue while bad guys and monsters are out there trying to stop you. Tell me about that and tell me what it takes to create the proper mindset to deal with such situations.
Yes. Yeah, so I'll tell you two perspectives. I'll tell you the overall perspective, what we look for or what made our unit successful. And then I'll tell you my personal, my personal experience and adaptation for me to be able to produce and function in that capacity in law enforcement as a SWAT operative. Firstly, when in my particular unit, and I'm just going to specifically talk about my unit, when you first get there, this was like 30 years ago when I first got there, and I kind of exercised the same thing as my career went on in SWAT. Because I became, the one thing they teach us in that unit is you eventually become an instructor. That's hands down, you will become an instructor. Mm-hmm. And so when I first got there, the first thing they said to me, one of the first things they said to me, and this is something I pass on to, and I asked some of the questions, and I also filter other candidates out with the same perspective, is when you go into a hostage rescue, you have to see it as if you're protecting or come trying to save your own child, your own mother, your own brother. If you can't do that, if you can't put yourself in a position to see it that way, then you can't do that job. And that's the way Miami-Dade SWAT, SRT perspective was 30 years ago. And it kind of migrated. I mean, it kind of took a flow and change and change as time went on. So with that being said, that's how I came in with the mindset. That was my growth. That was the seed that was put in me from the very beginning. And we have from the 30 years, that's something we just dealt with heavily in Miami. Whether it was domestic, whether it was some kind of opportunity or situation that was a robbery that became an opportunity because a law enforcement officer was there and they just took the opportunity to take someone hostage. It's so many variables in hostage rescue, but that was something I've dealt with for 30 years. So in my progression and growth in that, my perspective, what made me take it to the level how I performed for my 30 years is the experiences, each individual experience that you have, whether they were good or bad, and most of them were good, but sometimes we've been successful in that unit in Miami-Dade with our hostage rescue situations that we dealt with. But we had some bad ones where you didn't get there in time and the victim was slayed, murdered, however you want to call it. They were murdered. So you had to experience that. And one thing you realize is that the job that you're doing is real. It's not a joke. You can't come in a unit and think that you're just going to show up and you're going to have to perform. I am telling you, in that unit, in Miami-Dade, you will be exposed because you're going to deal with those situations and you're going to be in a position where you have to respond with the highest level. Because if you fall short, someone loses their life. And when you look at it like that, when you realize the reality and you see the deaths, you see them, it becomes real. So when I trained, in the process of my training changed. Although I've always trained hard, but when you see the reality of life and death and you're responsible for that, it puts a different level in you. You have a mindset that you cannot fail. There is no failure in this. If you fail, you die, your teammates die, and more importantly, and I say more importantly for a reason, the person you're trying to save dies. Because if you put yourself over that person, the victim you're trying to save, and everybody doesn't have this perspective. Everybody cannot do this job because it's hard to see and think this way. if you put yourself before that person, it's going to be self-preservation. You will not go in harm's way to save that life. Mm. Now, the victories in saving a life of a child, I always go back to children because that's the most, probably the most delicate beauty and a valuable thing that we have in life, because that's our future. You let our children die, then you have no future. So when you have a situation where someone's trying to destroy our future, and you save that life, you save that future, you save that baby lives on, and it gives you a victory and a reward that no one can give you other than experiencing it. And the same thing when you lose that life, it's the same, I guess the same degree of negativity is that same range of degree of negativity and the same range of positivity, whether you lose negative or you win that life. So that's always been my core, I guess my motivation, not just my motivation, my reason, my discipline, it's a purpose. That's the word I'm looking for. It gives you a purpose that overrides all things, your risk, your sleep, your time, and believe it or not, your family. Your family have to be a type of family that understands somewhat responsibility. They can never completely understand, but be able to willing to understand the responsibilities you have, because if you're not at a level, they lose.
Yes, sir. So having that it seems, you know, having a clear definiteness of purpose that drives you to a higher calling, because everything you talked about here is service-based, where you have to be able to put other people above your needs. But like, I think that's something really profound you said about treating the potential victims or hostages as like your own children, your own family members, and to have that fortitude, and especially, you know, I think there's different times, and the number of times, like I know you had mentioned to me how many times you've had to experience these situations, especially in that Miami-Dade area, versus, you know, not to like talk down or anything else compared to other people with regards to the number of situations, right? So the number of times you have to deal with is very difficult. You have to deal with it once in your life, twice in your life, but you guys, it was like a regular thing, right?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Yes.
So, you know, with regards to that, then in training, how did your training change then? You know, like how did it train, and how did that influence your personal training and then the training of a team together?
Yes. So, and that's a very good question. I'm glad you asked that. So, like I said, my background is started with Nisi Goju Karate and Japanese Jiu-Jitsu. And the system I come from, my instructor, Master Herbie Thompson, he's a ex-military. He fought in Vietnam. He fought close quarter battle, close quarter combat. He fought in the what they call them, and when they were going to the hole, they were what they call them, tunnel rats. That was a term. They were tunnel rats, so they would go face to face and they would fight the people or the enemies at the time. They were fighting them face to face, close quarter combat, knives and guns. It was close quarter. So he had real experience in that. So when he found out, because I trained on him since I was a kid. I'm just trying to make this short, this particular point, but I have to say this in order to give you an explanation,
yes,
of the progression of how I changed and my system changed, adapted to what I was doing. But anyway, his background, I started as a kid under his students. I trained for years under the system. When I became an adult, became in law enforcement, my first years on the road as a police officer, a uniform officer before I got in SWAT, I decided, I said, well, I'm going to go train with Master Herbie Thompson himself. And I'm glad I made that decision, because once I made that decision, he understood I was in law enforcement. So he trained me a little bit different than the regular students, which in time I got my black belt on him. But I also started started competing from point fighting, and I didn't like point fighting. I got into full contact. I fought full contact in Miami Florida, not Miami, but Florida for about 5 years. I got a middleweight championship title in Florida, the state of Florida. So my competition mindset was there, but I realized once I was on the road as a police officer, you had to fight people from time to time. And I got real good at talking people into hand, because I'm talking bad people that really need to be arrested for whatever reason. I had a skill in talking to people and into handcuffs, but every now and then that 3% you had to fight. So what I realized, I quickly found out, fighting with a gun on you, fighting in a ring, and fighting in a traditional school had to change. Things had to change. And when we were in the academy, they talked about that. But when you learn in the academy and what you learn in school, when you fight on the streets and you fight for your life, it's a different fight, especially when you have a gun on you. So I had to change certain things. I had to change how I approached things, how I fought. If I fought on the ground, I had to fight a certain way. And back then, ground fighting wasn't a big thing unless you were doing judo. Judo had, because Brazilian jiu-jitsu hadn't been introduced into martial arts at the time. But I had to make an adaptation with the knowledge I had at the time. So as I progressed on, I learned a lot. I changed a lot of my fighting. And I changed a lot of things to more, instead of ring fighting, I had to learn how to fight combat sense, combat sense of fighting, because many times you had to fight. You start out with a fight, but then you had to fight for your life, because sometimes people go for your gun. So my mindset started changing. I started processing things different. But what I realized early was form follows function. And this is where we fail in law enforcement. And I think we fail in martial arts, the martial arts world itself. We'll take a form and we'll force it into the function, whereas the function should dictate your form. And I realized that. For example, if I was doing, I'll just use Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu right now, because I study Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu now. I study all martial arts. I never stop learning. So in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, the fighting is on the ground. It's a very, very effective system. I'm sure you know that, because you're high ranked, and I think you might be a black belt. I'm not 100% sure.
Yes, sir.
But your Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is you're solid on that. But when you have a gun on you and you're on the ground, it changes your perspective. So you have to take that in mind and say, okay, how can I digest this challenge? And if this is a challenge, it's not a problem. When you look at things as a problem, it becomes a negative. You have to look at things in a positive sense. So you have to say, how can I digest this challenge here and make it work effectively? Not survive, because we can't survive. Surviving is not an issue when you're talking about law enforcement. You have to be the one that wins or control the situation. Surviving is, oh, I got away, I'm safe, and people die. You have to be the ones that win. So that's the mindset you have. So when you start on the ground, you have to think, what do I have to protect when I'm on the ground? And the one thing I did realize is that underhooks are good on your gun side. That's just an example. Getting that underhook on that person on the gun side, whether you're on the ground or whether you're standing, get an underhook on your gun side, then you can protect your gun, plus you can control that arm. And you work from, that's just a little small portion. I'm just giving you an example of form follows function. Because when you're fighting with the gi on, or you fight with no gi, you got weapons on, man, you can move, you can let them get the side, you can do all kinds of things. But when you have a gun, you can't do that. I'll give another example. When you're on the ground, knee on belly, if I'm right-handed, because my law enforcement, especially when I got in SWAT, my knee on belly is always with my left knee. Because with my right knee, my gun is closer to him.
Yes, sir.
So that's just explaining what I mean by form follows function. And as I progressed from the street and I got in SWAT, things changed even more, because now I'm wearing this vest. Mm-hmm. This vest that can be from 20 to 40 pounds, and gear, a helmet. You can carry from 40 to 70 to 100 pounds of gear. Fighting with that gear on changes everything. And then fighting smart and tactically changes everything. Instead of blading your body, think about this. This is, like I say, form follows function. Instead of blading your body in a fight, because boxing, you blade your body in a lot of things. You have to fight more like back in the day in the samurai, when they wore their body armor, they always faced.
Yes, sir.
They rarely turned to the side. The reason being, because your vulnerabilities, where you're vulnerable with your gear on is your sides.
Yeah.
You get stuck. Even when you have shoulder pads, you still have to be careful about your side. So when I had to learn how to fight in a frontal position. So a lot of things altered, because that's where my strong point was. Blade my body, I'm weak there. I'm very vulnerable there. If I take a round to the shoulder, it can hit my vital areas, and even hit the vital areas like my heart, my lungs, it'll kill you. In fact, we lost officers, not SRT, not SWAT. But uniformed officers have lost their lives had their body armor on. Bad guys knew it. Bad guys are very educated. Some of them were lucky, and they shot the officer on the side, and the officer lost their life. So a lot of things had to change for me. Fighting on the ground, because I did, in law enforcement, you have to fight on the ground. You have to have that. If you don't have that knowledge, then you're falling short in your law enforcement profession. So fighting on the ground with that heavy gear on, you have an assault rifle and you have a helmet, it's not effective. It's not effective thing. So you have to change your tactics along with your close quarter battle, close quarter combat. Switching from hands to guns, because a lot of times when we're in a house, houses are structures. And you have to deal with people. You have to put your hands on them sometimes. And it'll go from hands to actually to a shooting situation. It can happen in an instant. And when it doesn't go that way, and you have to deal with a person that's not deadly force, and you're using less lethal, which is your hands or whatever, you have to be able to fight them in a way with your gear, all that gear on, with your rifle, your handguns, and you have to learn to fight that way. So things change. Your form has to follow your function. If you try to take I'll give you another example. We in our unit, we train with some of the top military in our country. And I remember one of the units we trained, I won't say who they were, and it's not a negative thing, because they're processing things too. They're trying to learn. When they started going over in Afghanistan, when we started fighting over there in the Middle East, they were finding out that sometimes they had to do the same thing we were doing. You start out with your hands, you go with a gun, you start with a gun, you have to go with your hands. So they started trying to learn Brazilian jiu-jitsu and mix it in there. And they found out the same things that we were finding out at the time is that with that gear on, rolling on that ground, you can't roll on that ground with chicken plates. And I mean, if you have to, you have to. But you always want to maximize your success and maximize their failure. What I mean by that is you always want to try to put yourself in a certain position where you're in control and you can dictate what goes on to that fight instead of them being in control. Meaning you want to approach it a certain way and have that foreknowledge before it happens and be able to apply that as it happens. If that makes any sense to you.
Yes, sir. 100%. 100%. You know, I really love how you broke that down, because I think one of the things for those that are listening that are not, those are in law enforcement, this serves very big time for them. But even for martial artists that aren't in it, you know, how can we take a look to see, does my form follow my function, you know, and have it as an experimental process, right? I think that's the key thing here is, can we make it an experimental process? Because no two individuals are the same, right? Their attributes are not the same. Their psychologies, their mentalities are not the same. Some people have injuries. Some people are quick. Some people are fast. Some people are strong. Some people, and we all are going to age, right? We're all going to age. So how do we change and transform to be able to do that? I think it's such an important thing. I'm really glad you brought that up. But like going down deeper into the, you know, I work a lot with law enforcement as well. And once you hit the ground with the gear on, once you hit the ground or get in a grappling situation and you have your gun with you, it does change the dynamics to such a different degree. Even if you're rolling on the ground and a knife comes out, it changes what you're going to do. You're striking and biting and things of that nature. You start adding those things to it. It changes it, right? So I think one of the key things for the listeners to listen to here is that you have to have the sport aspects of it to get pressure, get used to angles, timing, and distance. However, then we have to make scenario-based changes and play roles, right? What are your thoughts on that in training and the importance of setting up scenarios and playing roles that we have to spar in, you know, because we have to do it safely to protect our partners, mm-hmm. to simulate these situations. What are your thoughts on devising, you know, methods of that nature and how do you teach it?
Okay, yeah, scenario-based training is extremely important in law enforcement. And I can tell you this, and even in civilian world, because I teach civilians, but I mostly teach law enforcement now and some military, and I cover those areas. I cover a lot of areas of personal protection and home defense. That's pretty much what I teach. I teach the craft of what I know, Nagasudo Jiu-Jitsu. And I think with civilians as well, scenario based is extremely important. Walking from the car to your house. And I know these things because of law enforcement. I know how most criminals are how they attack people and what they look for, and they look for people being vulnerable. A lot of attacks occur. I'm just going to talk about civilians right now, then I'll get into law enforcement. Yes, sir. I'm going to be real brief with civilians. A lot of civilians are targeted when they walk from their vehicles, from the car to their home, being aware of those type of scenarios and how to train specifically in those scenarios, get them aware of those things, get an experience that it's an environmental thing. People get an environment and they act a certain way. It's true. People inside a store, that environment, they act a certain way. They're on their phones. They share their phones. They're in a not a socializing mode, but a shopping mode, and maybe social. When they're in a movie theater, it's totally different. When they go shopping and they get in their car, they get to use environments. They become habitual. They have habits of what they do. So what you have to have a knowledge of how the criminal acts and what they look for. You don't have a knowledge. You're fishing and hoping. When you have a specific knowledge on what you're dealing, what your challenge is, you can be a lot more effective. So in that sense, scenario based for civilians are superb. You'll get a lot of success in that. Now with law enforcement, same thing. And it depends on, like for us, SWAT scenarios totally different than the road uniform officer scenarios. Now, in a sense that SWAT operators or SWAT operatives, they still have to be able to adapt and adjust, not just in a group, but singular too, because they're always law enforcement. Once they leave the unit, they go home, they're doing shopping, they still are a law enforcement officer, and they got to learn how to fight individually and collectively. So in SWAT scenarios, you have to know basically. It's a little more complicated because the diversity of the scenarios are the calls that we deal with are from hostage rescue to building search to fugitive hunts, homicide hunts, meaning that sometimes, and I call them campaigns, sometimes there's a bad guy. I mean, horrible. Some bad things happen in the world, but I know specifically in Miami what happens there, at least when I was there. You would have it for some reason, the criminals in other parts of the state, they have a tendency to migrate to Miami. We get information and we go on a fugitive hunt. So we'll start out with a location, some information with cooperations with feds, other local law enforcement. And we'll come together and we'll put our resources together and we'll track that person down. Meaning we might start in one part of the county, hunting that person down, and it might start to a structure, and you're in a field fighting in an open field with a dog, canine dog assist you. They're totally different fights. So you have to have scenarios for those specific things. And you need to have also with that experience where you have experience where these things have actually happened. Based on these experiences, we're going to address these things. But you also have to be open-minded for other possibilities. So you train them for experience-based scenarios, something that had actually happened, and then you have to train with, by your experience from dealing with law enforcement and that opposition, and I'll call it the bad element, their mindset, what they would do, what they'll possibly do, what are the angles that you need to approach, and you address those things so that they won't just have that one type of mindset or situation. They have multiple avenues, because I tell you, you can train a certain way. Once you put the opposition in there, it's going to change. The fluctuation is going to change, and you have to be able to adapt and change with it. So your scenarios have to be that specific, but you have to train your people also to be capable to make that adjustment. And those things are also applied whether you're training civilians, me personally training civilians, or law enforcement. So they're very important. And I'll add something else. And law enforcement should always train with some type of firearm on them when they're doing these scenarios, with contact, previously before the contact. When I mean by contact, there's contact, the confliction has happened, there's a physical contact. There's something that happens before the contact. Can they read the situation? And then after the contact, how you adapt, how you control it, how you resolve it, how you're going to secure the situation. All those things have to be in the scenario. You can't just be, the struggle you did, you're gone. Because it has to be, everything has to be thorough. And I get this from my unit, the unit I just came from. You have to be completely thorough with everything. Your training has to be from the point of previously before the contact, then after the contact, how you're going to adjust it, who you're going to get to can support you. Because sometimes you have to also realize this, in law enforcement, you always have to think you're not just fighting one person. because they're like law enforcement too. You have to, I always like to say this, this is something else too that can help you. I always say, when you're dealing with bad elements or criminals, you have your white belt criminals, mm-hmm. your yellow belt criminals, your purple belt criminals, your brown belt criminals, and then you have your black belt criminals. The black belt criminals, you have to train for them, because the ones in between, they're opportunists, they kind of know. But the black belt criminals, they have backup. They use cellular phones. They have things coordinated. They have plans. And law enforcement is always, remember this, is always reactive.
Yes, sir.
Meaning that bad guy or that bad element has to do something in order for us to act a certain way. So they're always one up on us, providing that their training give you a certain advantage by giving you a couple of steps. And those couple of steps makes a difference in a hand fight, especially in a gunfight or a knife fight. The worst thing you can do is ever be behind in a gunfight, because that's a hard distance to cover, because bullets travel fast. And if you're trying to figure out, well, what's going to happen, it's usually too late. And usually these things happen. And you know what happens? These things happen pretty fast. When it's a mostly life or death, when the contact happens, it's fast. Now, the buildup is not always that fast. Mm. That's what you need to read. Then that's the transition. So you're training for the buildup, the transition, and the actual confrontation or the contact, and then after that, so on. So, yeah.
I love that.
Probably a little more depth than you was looking for, but
no, I could have
been a little more on that. But,
no, I love it. That's why I wanted to sit down and talk to you. Because, you know, you're one of the people that has that experience, you know, and the other part is I love your analytical mind of breaking it down so everybody can learn from it, you know. Especially like, have you always had that approach with your mindset of like breaking things down, or was it forced by the job, or is that just how you're wired?
It was my martial arts. I started as a little person, a little human in martial arts, and I love that I started out not putting any other systems down. The Japanese system, traditional Japanese system, and very, very. The etiquette is extremely enforced. They make you think, they make you have to act a certain way. And the way they formulate your mind is, depending on your instructor, is like that. So that's how I process stuff because of my grooming in martial arts.
Innovators lead and the rest fall in line. When you're looking for martial arts gear, you want it made by someone who respects tradition but isn't afraid to push the boundaries. That's why I go with Century Martial Arts. The guys who brought you Bob, yes, that's right, Bob, the grim-faced opponent bag that John Wick shoots, Deadpool slashes, and I hit more times than I can count. These are the same guys that invented the freestanding heavy bag. When it comes to innovative martial arts gear, Century is the true OG. Since 1976, accepting nothing less than progress. Go to centurymartialarts.com. Don't forget to use my specific discount code to get great deals and let them know that I sent you. When checking out, use discount code BBPOD10. That's BBPOD10.
I love it. I love it. So, you know, as you were coming up and, you know, there's the physical side of the training and developing and sorting things out, both from an experiential perspective and then also planning for the situations of change that you've never been in. What are some of like the philosophies that inspired you? Did you read like Musashi, Gorō no Sho, the Book of Five Rings, or, you know, were you into that aspect of it? Like there's a lot of my friends that I've talked to in high level law enforcement and military that, you know, reside in some of those ancient teachings, and they love to read and the works of, you know, the greats like Musashi.
Yes. Well, see, I'm a reader. I love to read. I was a young little dude in my martial arts world, I, even though I was doing Japanese tradition, I was studying on my own. I was studying Kung Fu books, and because I just had a love for martial arts. The first book that I read that really, really impacted me was The Taiyo of Jeet Kune Do. I'm gonna tell you this. I was a little dude. I sat down and read that book in one day. I was so hungry. I started reading. I could not stop. I read that book in one day, and then I read it again. I read it again, and I read it again. So I think that was probably the first martial arts book I read. And then I don't read too many of those things. As far as it was another one I read a while back. what is it called? What's his name? I can't remember the name. Everybody know this book. War. Oh gosh.
The Art of War?
Art of War. Yes, The Art of War. I read that one. But I got to tell you, this is going to surprise you. The book that has helped me the most out of all books, get ready for this, is the Bible. Because right. In the Bible, man, there's, when you read it, it's a story that shows so much diversity, so many challenges, so many personal challenges, and it deals with a lot of war, deals with a lot of combat, the mindset of the warriors and how they think and how they act, and the valor and the honor behind it, the purpose behind why they're fighting. It really kind of coincided with my other martial arts, and I had a reality that guided me in my sense of philosophy of why I'm doing what I'm doing. It all just came together so smoothly, like water, my friend. Mm-hmm. It flowed like water. I had thought it in there, but it just flowed together, because when I look at how I was learning in Japanese, the Bushido way of martial arts is you weren't learning martial arts for yourself, but your inner self, to fight yourself, but you were also learning to help others.
Yes.
And I just love that, because I was always that kid. When I was a little kid, I was always small, a little dude. I'm still not a big dude. And I knew the bullies were coming, but me being bullied and fighting bullies in turn made me want to protect other kids who were being bullied. So I used to fight for other kids and from bullies. So when I put that together, my martial arts background and what I was reading in the Bible, I was like, man, this is great stuff. It affected me a lot. And it also translated over to my SWAT career, because I am telling you, you need a certain mindset and what's the word I'm looking for? A lawful mind and a mind with full of integrity, because you're going to be dealing with challenge. You deal with challenges that the natural human will give into, your emotions. You can't let your emotions, and I learned that in martial arts also. I'm talking about from the philosophy of martial arts and the book of Jeet Kune Do. And I read all kinds of books, jujitsu, Japanese jujitsu books, their philosophy. I read them. I read so many when I was a kid, and I'm getting this stuff. And that emotional content was always in there. You have to be in control of your emotions. Don't let your emotions control you. And it's also in the Bible. I'm like, man, this Bible thing, this thing has some stuff that really helped me and helped me in my martial arts. It helped me in my job, because I'm telling you, fear. And here's another, I have to throw this in. This might be a little bit off, but it's sort of the same thing. When I became a law enforcement officer, there was a philosophy and I had to reject it. And I'm glad I did. There's a philosophy where they say, yeah, fear is good. Fear is good. Fear reminds you of certain things and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. From what I know, from my experiences, fear isn't good. That's an emotion. And I had to, and I was a young kid becoming a law enforcement officer. And I'm thinking in my mind, I'm listening to these experienced guys talking about fear is good. These some fierce instructors who've been in shootings. But fear is good. I'm like, oh, well, that doesn't sit good with my philosophy, what I've learned, my knowledge. In order for me to do what I do, I need to understand that there's a threat. I would replace fear with threat. So I learned to replace the word fear with threat and what level of threat, and digest that and put it in its proper perspective. Be able to observe, assess that observation, and get the appropriate reaction. Fear, you respond, and it's an emotion, but is it the right response based on the emotion? And that's what I had to learn. And that all those things, the books I read with, things I picked up, because Bruce Lee was very philosophical. He would say some things, even in the Jeet Kune Do book, he would throw a little bit of philosophy. And I'm like, oh, I like that. That kind of works there. I like that. And then I read my other books and they'll throw similar things. I'm like, oh, I like this. And then I get the Bible and the Bible says, boom. I'm like, whoa, this is something I need to have in me. And as time translated and in my progression and just a kid, sports, because I was in sports. I competed in, like I said, I competed in, point fight. I hated it. And I did full contact, loved it. Loved it because it was hard to cheat a person unless it was a close fight. And then, you know, how it was with the judges. But other than that, man, I was like, man, all this stuff is coming together. It makes me think a certain way and it translated into my law enforcement. And I made the evolution of okay, I can't fight this way. I can't use these things. I have to use these things. Okay, form follows function. Let's see what's effective. And I had the opportunity to get out there to see what worked and what didn't work. And the philosophical things with books I read from all those things that I mentioned, all those things come together. And there are some things in there you go, not for what I'm doing and not this scenario. So you have to take certain things and formulas, I say formulas, and apply it to the scenario that best fits that need.
I love it. I love it. You know, I think it's such an important thing to understand fear, but our tendencies, right? What are our tendencies? What are our patterns? What are our likes? What are our dislikes? What are our preferences? So we can really truly study it so that we're not unconsciously dropping into a reactive pattern or a loop and you lose the ability to make a conscious choice. Even if that pattern was the right thing to do, if we're not choosing it, it can get us into trouble. But I really like what you said about fear of reframing it, you know, and that's the most important thing. Like you feel the difference between fear and being frightened, right? When that, like that's, yes. I think that's it. That's one thing that I like to share with people is which one is it? So fear is a signal for us to focus. It's a signal that, like you said, like a threat. I like the way you termed that and coined it, because it's so important to understand those things to see how do we bring ourselves down? How do we breathe? How do we calm down? What is the process that we use to do that so that we can manage our state, right? Because the state of the body, breath, and mind must lead the strategy and the tactics, and we can't just jump into what we're going to do, especially in those situations. So how do you train? Because like you could both sides, the civilian side, and because you're also a very highly decorated trainer of law enforcement and military and SWAT teams, how do you train that aspect for your clients, like with regards to dealing with fear? What are the steps you take them through to progressively prepare them for high pressure situations?
Reality. I you have to be honest, and sometimes you have to be brutally honest in the sense that you have to show them a picture of what they're facing. The reality has to be there. You have to be the reality. You have to get in the reality of death, because death is there. That's the worst case scenario that someone could possibly lose their life. That's something you don't want to happen. But if you're not telling your people that death can happen, then you're going to get them in a situation where they're going to be surprised and startled, and they're going to fail.
Yes, sir.
That's the first thing. You have to get them to understand the reality of the evil that is out there. It's no other way to paint that picture, but just call it what it is. There are evil out there, and there's levels of this evil. There are people out there that, and here's, I'm going to go with this, and I'm just going to tell you how I tell you. You have to look at it like this. You have children, and most of the people I teach, they have children or whatever. I'm just going to address that one. That can probably give a better picture of what I'm trying to say. When I teach people that have children, family, mothers, or whatever, I'll say to them, I say, okay, you have to realize that you have to fight not just for your life, but for your seven-year-old right there, your seven-year-old, your three-year-old, your arm baby. If you fail, there are people out there will kill your baby, and they are. Not all of them will, but like I said, you got to train for that black belt, the black belt criminal. That criminal is, he's at a level of his criminal skills that will catch you and blow you away. So with that being said, there are some criminals out there, and I've seen it. They've done it. They've murdered babies. They murdered men that were in their 80s and women that were in their 80s when they didn't have to. And that's the one I'm training them for. So I'll paint that picture and I'll tell them experiences that I've seen. And I'll tell them what they may have to face. And I'll tell them this is what we're training for. From that all the way down to no, just being aware and not putting yourself in that situation. Being able to read this. Don't be on your cellular phone and certain things. They're looking for people with their phones. Criminals are that way. And you look at the majority of the people, they're like, listen, I train from that all the way down to how to stand when they're in stores. When you're at the bank, don't turn your back to the door. Turn your body to the side so you can, because most banks, the opening of the door is your backs are facing it. So mm-hmm. from the point I tell them, listen, when you're in the bank, turn your body to the side so you can see what's coming in. Pay attention. Look at the reflection. See what's coming in. Because sometimes you can see things before it happens. And you can, and that right there give you an advantage because catching you off guard is something else. So yes. how I do is that, like I said, to answer that question, I give them the reality of what they may be facing, death for themselves, death for their children, or, and here's the other thing, you may have to take that person's life. And you have to say this, are you willing to fight for your life, your children's life, if that person's trying to take your life? That has to be a reality that has to be accepted. Don't get people to start training them. Hey, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Before you go any step, you have to make them see that reality, because then their mindset and their purpose change. It's not an exercise anymore. It's training. It's not me getting in shape, feeling good about myself. It's me fighting for my family, fighting for my child, fighting for my life. And I can't fail. And here's the other thing I tell them. If you're fighting for your child, you can't fail. You have to be willing to lose your life for that child in order to win that fight. Are you willing to go that far? Everybody can't do that, but that reality should be there. That should be something discussed in your training, because the reality, when it happens, watch these videos on YouTube when these people are invading homes and they're robbing people and they're killing. Watch them, because that's the reality right there. Not all of it, but you need to look at that so you can say, I understand what he's saying. I understand what he's saying, because if you haven't seen this, you'll say, man, he's talking very dark. But we're talking about fighting against the dark. So yes. How can you train a person to fight against the dark if you don't tell them it's dark? Because then that's that environmental effect. If you don't get them used to that environment, that's going to come on them all of a sudden if they're not paying attention, because that's how it is. It's sudden. But if you train them right, it won't be sudden. They'll read it before it comes. They're paying attention. They see these cars keep circling. Hey, get my kids. Let's get them out of the way. This, I see something's not right about this. I turn my back a certain way because I'm at the store. Oh, I see these guys coming in with guns. I can get myself in position to get my children safe. Instead of right up on you with the gun, you can start altering yourself so you can maximize your success and maximize the failure. Everything you do and everything you treat, train and everything you teach, from the mindset, the conversation, you're starting to maximize their success to maximize that threat or that bad element's failure. So that's how I start. Once I get that understanding, I have to train them accordingly. I have to train them. If first, am I training them? How and what am I training them in? Am I training with a firearm, knife, hand? What am I training them? I usually train them with all those things. I train them because that's what I dealt with. It starts with the hand sometimes. What? It starts with the mind. It starts with the eyes, perception, what you see, your what you're perceiving, your observation, your assessment, and then the reaction upon that. It starts with that. And then that, like I said, that contact starts with the hand, or it might start with the gun or a knife, and then it might start with the gun or knife and then go into the hands. It both happens. The guy gets a gun. Now you're fighting with the hand and the gun. You have to know how to manage that and deal with that. All those things come into the training. And you have to have that in reality. So once they get that reality, you start grooming them and training them. And drill. I am telling you, drills are important. I'm a drill master, because when I train people, it comes to a point that they don't even have to think about the mechanical aspect. The mechanical aspect, how do I move my hands? How do I get my GUN, my gun? How do I get my knife? It's the body and everything's moving. You don't have to think about it, but the eyes are processing and reading the scenario. Now you just maximize your success and their failure. And then here's the part where I say, when the reaction, you're always reactionary, that gives you that edge over the reaction. If the bad guy's doing something, now it's like a chess game. You know, you can read what's possibly going to happen. They think you're a victim, but here, they think they're going to hit you here, but you're already here because of the way you set yourself, the way you train, the way you think, the way you process, the way you read the whole situation. Now you're waiting on that person to do that thing. You're ahead of them. So it changes. So now the officer or the civilian, based on the way you train, they're no longer reactive or reactionary from behind. They're reactionary from the head. Now they're waiting for that guy to do whatever it is instead of getting caught off guard. Now I have to respond. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. 100%. 100%. You laid it out so perfectly there with regards to how important the awareness is, starting from the awareness of how dark the situation can get, the real reality of it. That I think that's such an important conversation to be had in self-defense. If we're talking about self-defense, like you got to start at the nuclear bomb and started what it is that, like you said, I love the way you said the black belt criminal. But I think the other key thing here that's so important is you start with the mind and training the eyes and training the perception, because we're living in a world where people are so distracted. They're very not aware of their situation and circumstances. They're stuck in their phones. And so for predators, I mean, it's like the bank is open, right? The vault is open, the bank is open, and there's no security over there. Then that ability to become the watcher, become the observer, be present, which is back to the whole concept of Bushido and the samurai spirit, or the spirit of what martial arts is about, is that wherever we are, the place should be safer. The place should be safer because of our awareness, because we are coming in a ready but relaxed state, and not paranoia. There's a big difference. I know you, we've talked about that before too, but the difference between paranoia and being prepared is two different things. And just being aware and in that state changes the game quite considerably. But I really like how you said of preparing yourself to be ahead of what they're going to do and waiting. You're waiting because you understand how this is going to unfold, because your training has prepared you for that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So tell me about this. Tell me about teaching. When you're teaching, because you have such a vast experience teaching, and we're teaching these things, what how do you transform your teaching methods first to be able to match the needs of the various different students and the environments they may find themselves in?
Good question. That's a very, very good question. So I have a good answer for that. People speak different languages. And what I mean by that, not verbal languages, the way they understand and the way they can, way you can get to them to get them to understand what you're trying to get across. And how I say, and I'm telling you, I've learned this, law enforcement has taught me so much. It is just being in these situations, and whether it's a bad situation or whether you're training, whether you're in a briefing when we're getting ready to do a big hit, I've learned something because I've been teaching and training. When I first, and I have to say this, when I first started my martial arts journey, my instructor realized that I had an ability to learn and be able to translate that information to other students. And I had a gift, and I still have that gift. I realized that when I say something to one person, that person might read it different than the other person. So I said, wait a minute, why is that? Why? And I would say, well, why is that person? I was very observant. Why is this person not getting this? Why this person is getting it? And the instructor would say it a certain way. And he'll keep saying it a certain way. And they'll ask me, well, blah, blah, and I'll say it different. And the kid will go, oh, now I understand. And I said, oh, I see. The way he's saying and the words he's using, that person doesn't understand that language. So over time of realizing it as a little dude, time I started realizing people speak different languages here. Their perception is different. And I have to learn that person's language, how they learn. If they're a person that learned with hands-on, are they a person that you have to go in detail and detail and detail? You have to be able to do both as an instructor, all those things in order to reach the student. So once I identify how that student learns their language, their learning language is, I can get to them. It's easier. All I need after that is my experience, my capability, and wealth of knowledge and tools. Tools are extremely important. What kind of tools you have to teach them? So the first part, like I said, is you need to learn their language. How do they learn? People have different categories of how they learn. Once you can get that, if you have the right method, because some people don't have the right method. Some people, like I said, they're taking form and function and forcing it on the function. But once you have everything in order, a proper methodology, the support, the language of the person that understands it, it's nothing but progress after that. And drills. Drill, 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 And then, like I say, I'm going to teach you the drill, then I'm going to teach you off the drill. I'm going to teach you a pattern, then I'm going to teach you off the pattern, meaning that I have a series of sequence of technique or technique, and they do it over and over and over again. And they have something like boxing. Boxing is your one, two, and your three, right? They teach a pattern. But in a fight, the pattern is broken. So I teach on the pattern and off the pattern. That's another thing I do when I instruct and I teach. I drill with a pattern. I give them the different various scenarios that could possibly happen. Then I throw them, they have to read it at different levels and different speeds. So all those things come together, but based on your method and specifically what you're teaching.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's great. So, you know, when you're progressing and you're working with, let's say, civilians, and you're trying to relay these situations to them, how do you dial up the pressure for them so they don't panic? How do you manage the panic to pressure ratio?
I'm gonna give you a good example of that. So when I train people in handgun shooting, I don't use that, the beep. You ever see the time beeping thing?
Yeah, yeah.
They put a beep thing, because you got to understand the body, the mind, the emotions. When a confrontation happens, confrontation, I mean, you're in a fight, whether it's life or death, it can be an emotional thing. Remember I said that, talked about emotion. So the brain is processing something, whether you gave it something or not, are you trained at something, is looking for an answer to a solution. The brain is looking for that. So I don't use a beep, because a beep to me, it's good. It's a good tool. But specifically for what I'm teaching, I don't use it. I use the simple word threat. Reason being, because every time I train this person over and over again, they see the scenario, the gun, the knife, or whatever. It's a deadly threat. I'm telling them threat. The brain is processing that. And when the incident happens, it's going to know it's a threat, not a beep. Hmm. The brain, the observation, assessment, action, all those things, the brain has to work together. All those things have to come together. So minus the beep, when you start training a person threat, their threat, your brain is processing like a computer. Your brain says, oh, this is the answer. This is the threat. I see what it is. And the more you do that, it's like a computer. The brain works so fast, man. The brain processes. So the brain can process stuff so fast when you do it over and over again. The brain says, I know this program. And it becomes compressed and compressed. So the time frame of its processing is very short. So if I'm telling them every single time, threat, 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 and that threat is there, they're learning, processing in their mind that this is a threat.
Yes, sir.
Not a beep. This is a threat. Not a beep. Nothing wrong with a beep. But the threat process. It's also a learning process, not just a reactionary process. It's just a reaction. I got to shoot something and neutralize it. Or if you shoot a bullet, that's deadly force. So I don't want beep to be my response to deadly force. I want threat to be my response to deadly force. I am telling you, the brain, the ears, the eyes, all these things is a form of processing. And every time you train, you need to utilize those avenues that connects to your whole response.
Hey, 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 what's up, everybody? Check out blackbeltmag.com for new interviews, articles, and tutorials from masters, champions, and celebrities. We're focusing on your favorite topics like traditional martial arts, entertainment, combat sports, and self-defense. Also, this is your place to access premium content, including high-level articles, ad-free entertainment, and the entire digitized catalog of Black Belt Magazine issues from 1961 to the present. Visit blackbeltmag.com today.
I love it. I love it. So, you know, let's go a little deeper into something we had started talking about in the beginning of the podcast. And it's the state of the operator, right? The body, the breath, and the mind of the operator. And so there's the strategy and the tactics and how we train that. But the individual that's taking part in the event, as Bruce Lee said, is much more important than the event itself. How important is both the balance of physical, mental, and spiritual fitness?
Well, one without the other, you will fail eventually. All those things have to be intact. Everything has to be intact. And I'm talking about if you're going to be really dealing with situations like hostage rescue, where people are going to die if you don't respond properly. Your mental state, your physical state, your psychological state, your spiritual state, all those things have to be. Why the spiritual state? Well, there's more to a fight than physical. There's a spiritual driven force in you that collaborates with the rest of you to drive you for the purpose that you're supposed to be there for in the first place. It has to be something spiritually driven, because we are spiritual beings, believe it or not. The term, man, you got to have the right spirit. You hear that before, the winning spirit. Those things are true statements, because you have to put yourself in the right set, the right spirit to be able to do a certain thing. You have to beef yourself up to, let's have this party. Let's get worked up. Even before football games. You get rowdy. They're building their spirits up. They're building that, not just emotion, that's a spiritual building for something, an event that's going to happen. Same thing for what we do. Same thing for why you're going. I'm going to talk specifically about a SWAT operative. They have to have a spirit mindset in a sense of, I have to go back to this is what we do. This is our profession. This is an element that's extremely important in our profession, is life and death. It has to be addressed. So you have to have a spiritual sense that, you know what? I may lose my life. I may have to give up my life for someone to live. Spiritually, you have to be in peace with that. Because if you're not spiritually in peace with that, you're going to always struggle when you get in that environment, and you're not going to be complete. You can train physically. Oh, I'm strong. You can be sharp with your gun. Boom, boom, boom. And don't miss a beat. But when you get in that scenario and you say, oh, shoot, oh, man, I might die, you fail. You will fail. Because I'm telling you, it's fraction and inches and fractions to success in that. You're a fraction too short, you die. You're a little bit too slow, you die. A little too fast, you die. So that one little thought process, I might die, then somebody just died. I'll tell you what I mean. This right here can cause a life. I'll tell you how. Because when a group of guys are stacked, you got your primary penetrator, secondary penetrator, your third penetrator, then you have your floaters. That's the formula that the name we use. Different units use different things. But the primary guy's that first guy going, the second guy going. They have to be in there to help that guy fight, right? So this right here may cause that first guy to lose his life, because I'm not in there at a certain time. Timing is everything. If I'm going too fast, he dies. If I'm going too slow, he dies. Somebody dies. So time is a big issue when you're talking about the operator, because we all talking about the operator, right? When you're talking about the SWAT operative, timing is extremely important. That correlates to your spiritual mindset, your spiritual heart. Where are you? Where are you spiritually? Are you spiritually willing to give up your life? Because if you don't, you go, wait a minute, we're going to die. And that guy's in the room, and then bah, 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 he's under fire, and you're still hesitating at the door. Now you get in. That guy loses his life. So spiritually, you have to be intact. Physically, of course, you have to be strong. Physical strength. Endurance. You have to have endurance, because you can't get tired. You can get tired, but you got to be able to work through fatigue. You got to have your coordination. So your time and your ability to move and to be able to keep your balance and change angles, all those things have to be sharp. Now, let's talk about the other aspect. Let's talk about your skill level, your shooting skill. Your shooting skill, you can't miss. There is no missing. Not with a hostage rescue, there's no missing. So you're talking about different levels of training, your physical strength, your agility, your endurance. Now you're talking about your shooting. Okay, now let's talk about that shooting. You got a handgun. You need to put hours and hours and hours and hours of your handgun shooting. But now we got a rifle, huh? Now you got to put hours and hours and hours and hours on your rifle. Now, if you're a shotgun man, because you're a breacher, and that's also a weapon of opportunity from breaching to a shotgun. Breaching means those are rounds that actually penetrate doors. But you can transition that to actually rounds to be able to penetrate a deadly threat. So you have to put time with that. How much time do you have to do that? Now you're talking about a lifestyle. Not just, I'm going to show up and train. No, this is your life. This is your lifestyle. This will get done. And I can tell you this. Here's the challenge that we have, because we're still talking about training. So in my, and I can only talk about my unit. And I know about other units, but I won't talk about them. In my unit, we're busy. We, like I said, we have campaigns. I go back before I retire. The year that I retired, the year before I retired in Miami, we had, it started out with some federal agents. They were just, they were doing a search warrant and they were shot and killed. So they backed off on their search warrants and we had to carry their load. Miami-Dade SWAT, SRT. And around that same time, we had the Cuban crisis. The Cubans were having an uproar and having riots. So we had to deal with that too. This on top of each other. Then a building collapsed. The building collapsed in Miami, made a big thing. It was all over the world. Everybody from all over the world were coming to show support because of the lives that were lost in the collapse of that building. Hundreds of people lost their life. You had dignitaries from all around the world coming there because we do dignitary protection. Now, on top of that, we had a massive shooting with these gangs. And here's the sad thing. The gangs were from the ages of 10 to 16 years old to maybe 17. Young kids doing massive shootings and killings all over Miami. And we were doing manhunts. We were child hunts, but we call them manhunts. Child hunts during that time. Homicide was hunting down. We're doing co-ops with some of the federal agency and their resources. So we're hunting these people down. Now, on top of that, we had the assassination of the Haitian president. He was assassinated. His wife was shot. They brought it into Miami Jackson Hospital. We was responsible for protecting her for 24 hours a day for the time, for like about 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember the duration. It was almost a month, 3 weeks. But all these things overlapped. Think about it. We only have, at that time, maybe 40 guys in that unit to cover all of that. So, you know, we got no rest. We didn't sleep. We slept sometimes at the location in our cars to be able to respond to these things because you couldn't go home. Now, think about this. Where did we get time to train? Now, we got to be extreme proficient at what we do. We can't miss. But you know what we did? We make it happen anyway. With a little bit of sleep we get, because remember, it's a lifestyle. We have to digest. We have to cut off time and say, well, listen, you're not going to spend time with your family. That's out. But I have to be able to, when I pull this weapon out, I got to hit my mark. We can't miss because we're still with hostage risk. We're still getting hostage rescue. We're still getting these other, our regular stuff, manhunts, robberies with the people bailing out and they're hiding in neighborhoods. We have to hunt them down. You were still doing this stuff on top of this. So we have to get our shooting. So what we do, we're very, very creative. Some of us, we get in our vehicle because we keep weights. We keep, I have laser weapons, like my laser guns. That's what I train people with. I have my laser gun. I'm running my laser gun, getting my proficiency in the best I can. So if I have to pull out dry fire, people doing dry fire so they can have this, they're making it happen. There is no failure. There is no, you don't have enough time. You have to make the time. And you rest. And they constantly have an energy drink in their hand because they have to be able to stay awake while that happened. And I saw that with the SEALs, Delta, and that same, I mean, it's sort of like a culture, man. When we were training with these guys, they had their energy drinks. I'm like, wow, it's not that much different, except for they're over there domestic and their training is a lot more in depth than ours, but we get ours in too. So with the training aspect, brother, the physical part, the mental part, the spiritual part, all those things have to be intact. And then on top of that, like I said, the other aspects of your handgun shooting, and then the defensive tactics. So we got guys that's in mixed martial arts, some guys are in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I'm into what I teach. And we'll get together. We'll get a little bit of training in what we can to get it in, to keep ourselves sharp as we can. We make it happen on site, on the ground. We'll work on a little bit of this, maybe some grappling stuff, up close stuff or whatever. You mix that stuff in when you can, and then you're sleeping in your cars to get your rest and you're responding to a different location. So you have to make it happen. The physical aspect, the mental aspect, the spiritual aspect. The spiritual aspect comes from that portion. You got to have enough spirit to say, okay, God, let's make it happen. Because the motivation, you're too tired to be motivated. And discipline, yeah, it's discipline. But it's that spiritual sense that makes you say, you got to get up and go, no matter what. So yeah, I don't know if I will answer that.
No, man. That was spot on. So let me ask you another question here, in respect for your time, is tell me a little bit about what makes a good leader.
A good leader need to be a good follower first. He need to be a guy that's, he or she need to be a guy at the bottom first. And you need to lead, and you have need two type of leaders. You need a leader at the bottom, you need a leader in the middle, you need a leader at the top. But all of them should start at the bottom first. Meaning that the best leaders that you have, and I'm not saying leaders that haven't been in a scenario or situation or whatever they're leading, I'm not saying they can't be good, but the best leaders are the ones that actually been on the ground, been boots on the ground, kicking in the doors. And I'm talking about what I do. And that translates to anything else. The ones that experienced the event, have experienced it from the bottom and kept themselves humble and kept their heart and their mind in the right place with the purpose of why they're doing it. Purpose. If you lose the purpose, you lose everything. From all those things, aspects, evolving into experience and time, and they need the experience. That experience is so real, man. They need the experience, and they need the ability to be able to see talent in the ones that they're leading, and be able to put them in a proper place so they become an asset, and be the leader, the kind of leader that's willing to draw from everybody else the strong points when you come up with a plan. Bring everybody in the plan. Everybody, because some people might see something you might see, be humble enough to be able to involve everybody in your planning. But be strong enough to say, okay, that's not good. Based on your experience, we get killed this way, because that's how they learn. And a leader should be able to have a briefing at the beginning of what they do and a debriefing afterwards. Because if you don't do that, if you don't brief at the beginning, it doesn't have everybody together on the same page. Mm-hmm. If you don't debrief after, you never learn anything. In your debrief, you can't be sensitive. You have to call whatever it is what it is. And everyone has to come together. And then the progression of being able to pull everybody together based on you leading by an example. You have to lead by example. You got to get in the dirt.
I love it. And so adding on to that, how do we establish teams that move and think and in sync?
It starts from the very beginning of the recruiting process. You got to have the right people. Everybody can't do this. I don't care how much a nice person is. I don't care how strong you are. I don't care how fast you are. You got to be specifically made for that specific thing, and everybody can't do it. Everybody can. I've had friends in my unit, friends in the police department, good friends of mine, love them, come to the school to go through the process. I tell them, you can't do this job, Nate. Some of them don't like me after that, but I honestly know through processing, putting them through scenarios, they can't do the job. They're going to get themselves killed and somebody else killed. So the process of getting the right people, it has to be the right people. If you have the wrong people in, it's not going to work. You got to always keep the proper and the integrity of what you're doing and why you're doing it and who you're doing it with. It has to be on point. If you get the wrong person in there, they can destroy everything. That has to be a tight thing. That's how it starts, very beginning.
And how important is a code of conduct?
That's extremely important. You can't neglect the code of conduct. Because if people don't act a certain way, it's the same thing. Like I said, it goes back to martial arts, the etiquette of martial arts. There's a reason for how you conduct yourself. The way you conduct yourself is your mindset, your values, and it always will affect your purpose. You can't appreciate and understand and dedicate yourself to your purpose without proper code and conduct. You can't. It's not going to happen. You're going to fail.
I love it, man. Dexter, so good talking to you, brother. I really appreciate you coming on and so honestly sharing not just your experiences, but your wisdom gained firsthand. I respect you so much and really value our friendship. And I really want to thank you for coming on and sharing your wisdom and experiences with the audience. If they wanted to get in touch with you, they wanted to get training from you, how do people find you if you're available for them?
Okay, firstly, I have so much respect for you, C, for saying thank you for inviting me, man. And I always say iron sharpens iron. You definitely have admiration for me. And I watch all your stuff, man. I learn from you, brother. And you are a blessing, man. And I thank you for everything you do and what you're doing now. As far as me training and teaching, I'm very selective. I can't, in my right heart and mind, knowing what I know and seeing what I've seen, just open myself up like a regular business, because that means I would invite people that shouldn't learn this stuff. And I can't do that. So the ones who get in contact with me, they know how to get in contact with me. I have to keep it that way. And I'm very selective. I don't train it. I turn out a lot of people. And here, my interviewing process sometimes is a year to 2 years of me interviewing people before I even train. So the ones who train with me, they know how to get with me, because I don't train everybody. I don't, and I won't. I never will have thousands and thousands, hundreds of people to train. I'm very selective on who I train, because what I give them is something that I can't give to the wrong people.
I respect that. That's that code. There's the code, you know what I'm saying? That's why we get along so well. So last question, since this is the Black Belt Magazine podcast, it's a question I ask everybody. The final question is, what does a black belt mean to you?
To me, a black belt means to me a lot more than what I think most black belts see. I think a black belt has to be appreciative of a white belt in a sense of always learning. I even though I'm a black belt, I love being a white belt, because the value of a white belt learning and progressing to become better is paramount. I think a black belt has to be continuously in a learning mindset. And more importantly, humble, humility. When I first got my white belt, the first thing I was taught, white belt stands for humility. And I said, as I went on and my progression through all the belts become a black belt, I said, now to me, a black belt being humble is more important than a white belt being humble. Humility, leadership, integrity, patience, and believe this or not, love. You have to love people to be a successful black belt. Because if you're a black belt, you're basically saying, I'm going to be a teacher. If you can't love people and teaching them what you know for a purpose of protection and learning and growing, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. A black belt has to be a black belt for the right reasons. And my mindset, if you're not for the right reasons, you're just a person with a belt that's black without purpose.
Boom. I love it, brother. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and I hope the audience enjoyed it. I know they did as much as I did, and we got to get back on, and I can't wait to see you when you come back out here. We get some training in.
I'll see you soon, sir.
As martial artists, wherever you go, everyone is a little bit safer because you are there. Wherever you are, anyone in need has a friend. And when you return home, they're happy to see you, because it's a good life. Follow us on all major podcast platforms. Like, subscribe, and share. Until next time, my friends.